Hello, welcome once again to Searching for American Gods, a podcast on the television show American Gods on Starz, based off the book by Neil Gaiman. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the USA, and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
All right, how are you, Phil?
I'm doing okay. Let's see. So, once again, we do a podcast here for American Gods, discussing each episode of the show. This episode is the finale we're going to talk about, but we will have one more episode to discuss the entire season, put it in perspective, and our thoughts. We are under the darkdiscussions.com podcast group. It's basically a feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Also, you can go to darkdiscussions.com, or if you prefer, you can just search for searching for American Gods on any of those places and just choose to follow the American Gods podcast by us. But we do a weekly podcast on Dark Discussions, which is about genre movies. And after the American Gods podcast is over, we'll be doing a podcast on Game of Thrones Season 7 called You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, A Game of Thrones. Now, Mike, you may want to talk about a charity convention you're going to that people who listen to American Gods may be interested in.
Right. It's called Scares of the Care Weekend. This is their fourth weekend that they're doing. Scares the Care is a 501c3 charity organization run by former horror independent film director, former Baltimore police detective, former Army Joe Ripple. And they give money out, $10,000 a year, to three different families, usually one a family where there's a child suffering from a serious illness, a family dealing with breast cancer, and then working with Kane Hodder of the Friday the 13th franchise. They work with someone suffering from who's a burn victim, and they've already given out their first two checks this year, working on their third. And if they can raise enough money, they will probably add a fourth family for the first time. And so it's a charity weekend event. It's basically a horror convention. They're trying to avoid going at a convention because they don't, because again, it is all for charity, and they don't want to confuse people as to what it's about and where the money's going. You can find all the information on it at scaresthecareweekend.com, and you can find out about the charity and the people that it's helping at scaresthecare.org. You can find the names of the families. You know exactly where the money's going. Nobody who works for the charity is taking a penny in salary. Everything they raise after it's paid for, the obviously for overhead, goes straight to the families. And you can go visit their webpage, which is frequently updated. They have monthly fundraisers and lots of other things. People who do independent fundraisers, as we're doing right now, through their own efforts. We're right now selling T-shirts, which will probably be over shortly after this airs. But we're selling T-shirts until June 26th. That are Dark Discussions podcast T-shirts. You can find at booster.com/DDP, or just go to booster.com and search for Dark Discussions. So anyway, I will be down there. I'll be participating and doing three different panels. One panel with Elizabeth Catherine Gray on the role of vampires in horror. And we're going to be very happy to be joined by a legendary Baltimore, D.C. area horror host, Count Gore Duvall. And then we're doing two others, one on the horror films of 1987 and another on on horror podcasting. So you want to be a podcaster.
Very good, very good.
And that'll be July 21st, 22nd, 23rd in Williamsburg, Virginia. And, oh, by the way, with the T-shirt sale, if you do have managed to get in the last couple of days, we will be doing a raffle to give away two tickets to the convention for that weekend. No transportation, no hotel room, but at least you get free admission.
Right, right. And your chance of winning is pretty good, because it'll probably be about 1 in 20, I think, right?
Maybe not even that, depending on who buys, because people who are part of the podcast and family members of the podcast cannot receive the prize, just, you know, out of fairness. I'm not sure if legally we can't do it, but...
very well. All right. So so if you want to meet up with Mike at the convention, he'll be there. And some of his panels, or hopefully all of his panels, will be recorded. And if so, we will release them under the Dark Discussions podcast feed as special episodes of the podcast, so folks can listen for all those folks who were unable to attend. All right. So, and one of the people, as you said, is Elizabeth Catherine Gray, but oddly, we have nothing from her this week about Searching for American Gods.
But, well, she was at AwesomeCon down in the Baltimore, D.C. area, so that may have gotten her a bit backed up, and so she may not have gotten to the episode yet.
Very well, very well. But we do have a couple of episodes. I mean, not a couple of episodes. We got a couple of comments from Sean Quinn Robinson, one of our listeners. And this is what he has to say. He has a couple of things related to the episode as well as the prior episode as well as just in general. The first comment he has is, this is in relation to American Gods. Has anyone else noticed that the theme song is a reworking or a reimagining of Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song? Very similar notes and musical structure. If this is indeed the case, it's absolutely brilliant. And I see what he's saying, because the part where Robert Plant does the scream in that song, they do during the American Gods theme song as well. And being the Immigrant Song, it would fit nicely into, I guess, the show, Mike.
Yes. Yeah, I guess apparently I just did a quick online search to see if there's any way to confirm it or not. And I guess he's not the first one to notice it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So other people have noticed it as well. So it may be a possibility, but it would not surprise me that the folks who wrote the song may not admit it, because as we know, if you admit something like that, you could get sued, similar to what happened to James Cameron when he admitted that the Terminator had a little bit of a feel of a actual sci-fi short story by a writer, and I forget that writer's name. It was the same writer that wrote A Boy and His Dog. Anyway, have you ever heard that story, Mike, where he did a interview, James Cameron did an interview on the Terminator, and then someone asked, you know, where did you come up with the idea? And he kind of said, well, I got the idea a little bit from this short story from this guy, and I forget the name of the author. And then immediately that guy had heard about the interview, and he immediately sued James Cameron.
That was author Harlan Ellison.
That's it. Harlan Ellison.
He's kind of an irascible but very prolific author. I've met him a couple of times. He's nice, but can be very abrasive. So I don't know. And he has no tolerance for bullshit. He got reprimanded for going on Bill Maher's old show, Politically Incorrect, and he was reprimanded for being too politically incorrect. That's the kind of guy he is. So yeah. Anyway, yeah. So basically, it sounds like the because others have noticed a similarity to Immigrant Song, so it may just be that they couldn't get the rights to it, and so borrowed elements from it or came up with something that is stylistically similar to it.
Right, right.
That is, I want to be 100% clear, total speculation.
Yep, absolutely. I think it was Sean Quinn Robinson's speculation as well, as a matter of fact. He has a couple more things he wrote, and this is what he has to say. He goes, about to start the season finale of American Gods, but have a few things to say after watching episode 7, A Prayer for Mads Sweeney, for a second time. This is absolutely my favorite episode of the season, though it's completely expanding on what Neil Gaiman wrote. Yes, this could easily have been its own standalone tale in the universe, but there is a very good reason why it's here and why it's at this point. American Gods is just one book, unlike Game of Thrones, which is 5, and each one is twice as long as American Gods. So taking Neil Gaiman's wonderful prose and turning it into a series can be no small undertaking. It could easily have been a single 13 to 16 episode season and been just fine, but who are we kidding? This is television. I have read that the plan was to take the book and break it into thirds, thus giving us 3 seasons and potentially spin-off series like Nancy and Mad Sweeney. In order to do multiple seasons, the story needs to be expanded on, which is why we get such beautiful personal episodes such as this one. American Gods is not a typical story, nor is it a typical show. The characters themselves, in a way, are the prose, and the evolution of their emotional state is progression of the narrative. Unlike most shows that have an idea of where they'll end up, American Gods knows what the end game is, and everything we're seeing is leading to that. This leads me to the season finale. Audience should temper their expectations as to how this season will end. Don't expect resolutions or answers. This is only part one. More than likely, we'll be given a cliffhanger or a larger question to ponder. There may be a revelation or some proverbial shit hitting the fan. But like I said, this isn't a typical TV show. Now on to the finale. Any comments on that, Mike, before I read his last statements?
No, it makes me wonder why we're the ones doing the podcast. But yeah, no, good observations, good comments. And yes, this is not a typical show. And, you know, if you've been listening this long, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but I think most of the criticisms I've had for the show have been that it's not fit a typical TV show pattern, and it makes me concerned for its long-term viability for that reason. But I'm certainly enjoying what's happening, and I'll get into my minor criticisms of the final episode in a few minutes, I'm sure. But yeah, everything. The advantage is that they know where they're going. You know, the drawback is, are they going to be able to get where they want to go? Right? Are they pacing it out too much? Are they laying down things? They know where they're going, but are they making the path clear enough for everyone to follow? Or they're expecting everyone to just follow along because while they're on TV, people will watch. I'm hoping to get to their final destination. There's also marketing reasons and financial viability reasons why TV series tend to go long, right? This is not something that I would expect to run 100 episodes. But most TV series, you want to get a certain number of shows so that way you can syndicate it. And if you're only doing 3 seasons, that's only 24 episodes. So here they're looking for this probably just as a way to get some more subscribers to Starz. So they're not worried about, you know, getting 5 22-episode seasons out of it the way most TV series are. So they're dealing with different financial concerns. And unfortunately, the way the business works is we don't really know much about what the subscribers are and the cost of the shows and when you're dealing with cable. With network TV, it's a little bit more upfront because they have the weekly ratings published and everyone knows what the costs are and, you know, how is the show doing? Is the ratings up? Are the ratings down? And what that is in comparison to other network shows, so you can tell is that good or bad. With something like Starz, we have no idea how this is doing and how it's being perceived, right? We know we've seen the ratings and you cite them every week, right? And we've seen the ratings have kind of been going down. But we don't know how they are going to be in streaming in another week or two, if that, what the subscriber base is and how that's changed since they've started it. So there's all sorts of facts. All I can say is I'm enjoying it, and I'm hoping that – and I know it's going to go on for a second season. If it's only for 3, I hope we get to the third.
Right, right. Yeah, a couple of things. One, Sean Quinn Robinson has done Access Television – shows in the past, and he posted it when he used to do it, and so honestly he has done good material there. So speaking of someone that could do a podcast or something of it, Sean Quinn Robinson would be quite good. But the other thing I wanted to bring up that you mentioned, Mike, was television shows. Originally, most television shows from the 80s and 90s and then still on those networks, a lot of them are 24 episodes. And like you said, then they go into syndication and whatnot. While a lot of these other shows, like American Gods and whatnot are almost like advertisements for a network instead.
Right.
And also they're almost like elongated miniseries rather than a television show. So again, yeah, maybe that's part of the American Gods thing. I mean, it got us to watch Stars because prior
right.
to that, yeah, I hadn't been watching it recently.
And you look at like HBO, so they launched their own a mobile streaming service with HBO Now.
Yep.
I think there's HBO Go, which is for subscribers, and then they because they were trying to do this a while ago, but it ran into contract issues with the cable providers they have around the country. And so I guess with their new services, they found a way around it or worked it into their new contracts. And so they used something like Game of Thrones or any of their other independent programming like Girls and The Leftovers and all the rest, they're able to use that as a wedge to kind of open up the door to get people to come in and subscribe to the HBO service, which whatever it is like $10 a month or so. Even if you're not an HBO subscriber per se, cable subscriber, then you subscribe to the streaming service and they get their money back that way.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And they don't care about ratings. They care about subscribers.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's actually what I'm doing now for HBO is I'm doing HBO Now because I was going to do the regular HBO and then I would get the HBO Go with it. But Comcast wouldn't give me a discount on HBO. So since I could pay equal price through the Now system or Comcast, I decided to just go with HBO Now through iTunes and go that route. And basically HBO Now is basically the same thing as HBO Go, except you don't have to have the cable provider to go with it. Now, I got one other item from Sean Quinn Robinson, and this is what he has to say. He goes, American Gods, Episode 8, the season finale, Come to Jesus. Wow, I'm actually surprised at how rounded the finale was. I really need to read the book again so I can address the differences. Answers abound, threads tie together, and Wisconsin and the House on the Rock are on the horizon. I've been to the House on the Rock, and its relevance in the book is fantastic. So I can't wait to see it in season 2. Yes, they are going to film on location, which has me really excited. So if they do film in Wisconsin, that is where Sean Quinn Robinson is from, or it lives now and therefore calls home. So I'm sure that'll be pretty exciting. I don't know anything about the House on the Rock, except for what Sean Quinn Robinson mentioned, and then the brief sign we see in this finale. But I assume I could read and research it online. I just have not done so
well,
yet.
I'm actually looking at the Wikipedia page right now, and it says the House on the Rock is a tourist attraction located between the cities of Dodgeville and Spring Green, Wisconsin. Opened in 1859, it is a complex of architecturally distinct rooms, streets, gardens, and shops designed by Alex Jordan Jr. Then you can go look online at the various rooms and things like that they have there and the complex, and you can look it all up. But it's basically a tourist trap, and you know tourist traps have been figuring in for in like we saw the White Buffalo site two episodes ago.
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't know how this is going to play in. Again, neither of us have read the novel yet. So we'll see how it factors in. We do see it at the very end of the episode, and they've been talking about getting there from pretty much the beginning, and they just don't show us what happens when we get there.
Right. That's pretty much part of the cliffhanger, because there's really two cliffhangers. The one is seeing folks heading towards the House on the Rock, and then the other is the scene with Lara, and we'll discuss all that in a moment. That's all we have for emails. No other comments. So yeah, I think we can probably discuss the number of folks who've watched the episode and all that. However, before we do any of that, is there any general American Gods information, whether it's book related, TV show related, or miscellaneous related that you have, Mike? I don't have anything, but you may have something.
No, nothing specific that I can recall.
Okay. So with that, let me read some of the details about episode 7 and 8. Episode 7's final viewing viewership was 629,000. And this here, the finale, is actually the second largest watched episode. The season premiere was the largest. The season premiere was 975,000. Episode 8, entitled Come to Jesus, was 774,000.
Which tells me that there's about 100,000 people who are going to be really confused.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mike. Unless some of those that watched the season finale also watched the other episodes on demand after the fact, because these totals are really simple. Basically, most of these totals nowadays are those who were watching the moment the show started, or anybody who picked up on demand or the show as it was still on the air in that, you know, 60-minute time frame, and it doesn't pick up on-demand viewers. People behind this episode, the writers are Michael Green and Brian Fuller, the usual suspects and the folks who are the showrunners, but also another individual called Becca Brunstetter, and I don't have any further information on her. The director is Floria Sigismondi. Floria Sigismondi is a Canadian director. She's probably most famous for the movie, which I know you saw as well, Mike, The Runaways, starring Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. And Michael Shannon. So that's her only motion picture film, and she wrote and directed that. Otherwise, she's done a few television shows, an episode each of Hemlock Grove, Daredevil, The Handmaid's Tale, and American Gods. But her most famous stuff is mostly a music video director. So she's done videos for a large eclectic group of musicians and singers, including Rihanna, David Bowie, Justin Timberlake, Katy Perry, Fiona Apple, White Stripes, Incubus, Christina Aguilera, on and on, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, Sheryl Crow and Marilyn Manson, and so on and so forth. And that's this is her debut for the television show. And that's all I got about the background of this episode. Any further items that you wanted to bring up about that background?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, not much else really there. This episode was released on June 18th of 2017. We were recording this on June 20th, 2017, and it will most likely be released on the 21st or the 22nd at the latest. That's it. So I guess we can discuss this episode. I guess we'll be spoiler heavy. So most people who are probably listening to this podcast are show watchers anyway. So we're going to discuss and talk about all the things important. We're pretty much going to try to stick to this episode because we're going to do the series roundup next week. To start, Mike, this is where we get a little bit more about Bilquis to start out, right?
Yeah, we get Wednesday and Shadow Moon visiting Anansi, Mr. Nancy, who's working as a tailor, spider god, right? So it makes sense he sews, works with silk, and he's making them suits to make themselves presentable, and he stops to tell a story. And they have a little fun with that, with Mr. Wednesday kind of like, oh, please, no, not another story. And he tells them the story of Bilquis. And so we see Bilquis, who we have not seen for 8 episodes now, reappears. And we get her kind of backstory as one of the original goddesses, goddess fertility. And we see her decline and loss of power to all the way through to, sort of modern Iran, right, back in the 1970s, 1979, on the eve of the revolution.
Yeah, it's basically, what is it? It's, I would say there's really pretty much 3 to 4 vignettes in this vignette, because, like you said, it starts out with her in ancient Egypt / Sudan. And then it goes to, Ethiopia. It's actually Ethiopia. And then from Ethiopia to, fast forward by 2000 something, 3,000 years to 1979 Iran on the day of the revolution, as you mentioned. And then it flash forwards to modern day. But continue, Mike. Sorry, I just want to clarify that.
Right. Well, it's all about, and it's kind of about her loss of power and how, they have her flirting at a disco in Iran on the eve of the revolution. And then, of course, that all gets shut down. And I'm imagining she flees. I don't think she was probably booted out. She flees the country along with, I'm guessing, a female lover, a lesbian lover. And then we find out that the lesbian lover contracts AIDS and dies, and she's kind of left alone in the world. And homeless, and sort of because nobody's worshiping her anymore, so she's lost whatever power she had as a god until she is rediscovered by the new gods and Tech Boy. And Tech Boy basically offers her the world of internet porn, sort of like, they made a deal with Vulcan to make him the god of guns, and they tried to make a deal with Odin. Here, they offer her a cell phone and, I don't know, offer her the power of internet dating or whatever it is. I don't know the specifics, but yeah, the idea of hooking up a fertility goddess with modern technology has lots and lots of possibilities. And so she sort of reclaims some of her power that way and some of her relevance.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. It's kind of interesting. There's a rebirth where she's like this homeless person, and she sees a restaurant named after her, an Ethiopian restaurant named after her, and that gives her some hope. There's a scene where they show Islamic fundamentalists destroying temples and architecture from the BC times in Yemen. Yemen is only right across the sea from Ethiopia, so it makes sense that this goddess would spread from Ethiopia and Africa to the Middle East. However, as we know, and we've seen in other countries as well, like Afghanistan, some folks happen to destroy antiquities because they consider it heretic-like things, which is interesting or heartbreaking, in my opinion. As we know, Egypt has always embraced their heritage and loves their heritage. So it's odd how some people just have these odd belief systems to think that your heritage is bad. We do see, like you said, the Iranian Revolution take place. And oddly, Mr. Nancy talks about how this has something to do with the power and sex of woman, which I thought was, I didn't think fit really with the main story, whatever, it's in there for some reason. It's in there for whatever reason.
The idea is that he says you need a queen, and that will fit with the story because they are trying to recruit a queen to their cause, and both of them, when you think of it, are both fertility goddesses. So there's that in common.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting.
Well, anyway, we'll talk more about that later.
Sure. And so that's really the beginning. That's the vignette of this episode here, which is basically a quick rundown or a further understanding of who Billquist is and what she represents and where she actually originally came from, and how she adapts from being a living goddess on Earth to what she is today. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. Any further things you wanted to bring up about the Billquist story? Obviously, it doesn't really have anything much to do with the main plot, except this character will probably have some importance in future seasons. But it also does have one thing of note or importance, which is, like you said, you need a queen. And I'm not sure why that's important, except that you need more gods, I guess, or goddesses to fight a war.
Yeah, it's well, I was reading an interview with Orlando Jones, who plays Mr. Nancy, and he points out that there's been no one's ever won a war without support at home, right? So you've never had men generally have been the ones to fight the war. They've also needed the support of the women to do that. And he makes a point that if you look at Wednesday is kind of focusing on the men and excluding the women. He chases, as we find out in this episode, he deliberately severs the tie between Shadow and Laura. That he goes and we see him recruit Chernabog, but he ignores the women in the home. I mean, he flirts with them, he woos them, but he doesn't ask them to come with him to Wisconsin, or Wyoming, rather. Wait, was it Wyoming or Wisconsin?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Doesn't ask them to come to Wisconsin. So it's, again, sort of ignoring, he hasn't made an attempt to recruit Billquist. So you can see that he's maybe ignoring some of the fertility gods and the goddesses that would be valuable, and that may end up factoring in more with Laura's character. And I do kind of wish thematically they had another episode to bring this point home or explore this, and we just didn't get there. For me, that's sort of where the episode pulls up a little short, is that it's not the episode's fault, it's the season's fault, is that we seem like there should have been one more episode before the season ended, at least to me.
Yeah.
To sort of maybe bring some of these points home a little better. Or maybe they're just assuming the audience says, we'll get it, and I don't think it's as clear as it could be. And again, I'm finding this out through reading interviews with the actors on the show. It's not because I've necessarily had any brilliant insight on my part. And it makes sense. Oh, yeah, okay, when you explain it, sure, it makes sense. But it would be nice if it was as easy to piece together on a first viewing. And unfortunately, I've not had a chance to do a rewatch.
Sure. Yeah, I think one major issue is really if you're not familiar with a lot of the backstory of what's going on, you would be completely clueless in what's going on. The concept is pretty cool, obviously. I mentioned it from episode one of this podcast, how it reminded me of the movie Candyman, where the only reason Candyman exists, the monster or supernatural being, is simply because people believe that he exists, and therefore he exists. So I think that's a kind of cool idea. And this extends that by saying also believing gives them power as well. But again, I mean, unless you know anything about Odin and ravens, his two ravens and things like that, you'd be completely clueless about any of this. So it's definitely, as Sean Quinn Robinson said, a very different television show than anything we've seen. And he mentioned earlier, a couple of episodes ago, in one of his comments, is that it could probably be very difficult for anybody to adapt this Neil Gaiman book into a TV show. And I'm thinking that may be somewhat of the case, because a lot of the backstory that the layman who's viewing this would be clueless on would at least get that filled in during the written page of the book.
Yeah, like I said, there is a thematic link between Bilquis and Easter being fertility goddesses. And certainly we talk about new gods versus old gods. And we talked a little bit about this in the last episode. Where do you have a dividing line between new and old? So compared to Easter, Jesus is a new god, or, you know, but not necessarily compared to Technology Boy, right? And where does one draw the divide? Bilquis and Easter would be two of the oldest goddesses, and many of the old gods are fertility gods, right? You know, that are certainly every pantheon has its fertility goddess, because obviously the power of birth, the power to procreate, is vitally important to any culture. So they all figure prominently, just as I should point out, every culture pretty much has a god of war, you know, and a god of the sun or something. They all have some variation on those themes. They just incorporate them differently. But yeah, I don't think that connection is very well drawn. And once again, we start to bring Bilquis into this. She's certainly brought into this to show how the new gods are corrupting the old gods, but it's not made clear to me why we spent 10 minutes in two earlier episodes on her character, and why we would spend so much time away from her to bring her back for this, other than thematically sort of this fertility thing ties in sort of kind of with Easter. So the placement just feels a little weird.
Yeah, that's actually a good point, Mike. You could have cut out all of the Bilquis items from all the prior episodes and just had this vignette as they introduced various other gods and other vignettes, and that would have been fine, rather than having her in prior episodes when it didn't have anything to do with the main story plot, and therefore it may have confused folks and people wondering who the hell she is, especially since she wasn't really discussed as what she was. We knew she was some sort of supernatural being based off of what she did, but we didn't know anything otherwise. I mean, you could even argue that you didn't even know, people probably came out of those vignettes where she was in earlier not knowing that she was even a goddess. And so, yeah, it is odd that they chose to throw those in, except for maybe exploitation elements, you know, to get female nudity or something into the show earlier in the season. I mean, that's the only reason why I could think those vignettes were in there prior to this opening of her backstory.
Right. So anyway, I'm hoping, and I'm assuming she's going to play a bigger part later on.
Yep.
But again, later on is later on. I can't give them credit for doing something they haven't done yet.
Sure. Now, Mike, you did mention something that was curious, where the new gods are corrupting the old gods. And I don't know if that's what Neil Gaiman was writing, because, again, we haven't read the book. But if a god is trying to gain or remain powerful or remain relevant or remembered, could you argue that someone like Bilquis and her cell phone and U-Pawn and U-Date and all whatever else she uses now to gain power, and of course the Ethiopian restaurant, is that being corrupted or is that being relevant? I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it.
Well, I think we get a hint of it with, more than a hint of it with Easter, but it's changing them. It's offering them a deal and basically saying, we have a way to make you relevant again, but it's sort of relevant at in their control, right? Because they become dependent on technology, and the new gods are all technology centered, right?
Yeah, so that's true.
So Odin as a god of military technology, and Vulcan as a god of guns, and Bilquis through app dating or whatever it is that specifically they use her for, and Easter goes from being who she was to becoming sort of this kind of sort of Christian holiday, but not exactly either the Christian holiday or pagan holiday. The way she's perceived is not who she really is.
Right. Well, that's true, because even though Vulcan had guns, and Bilquis has U date and U pawn, and Easter or Ostara has candy and bunny rabbits and the birth the resurrection of Jesus Christ to use to gain power. They're still not being worshipped, right? So they're not the same as they were in their heyday when they actually had altars and temples and whatnot. And I guess the new gods are which aren't real gods at all because they aren't worshipped as a god would be worshipped. They are actually also changing what a definition or the semantical definition of a temple is, I guess, or a religious book is, by stating that, okay, now a TV and a cell phone can be considered divinity tools of the gods, just as a Bible or a Quran or a Jewish temple was in the past. So it's... Yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, it's... again, it makes me wonder if there's not some misdirection going on here with the new gods. Okay. Meaning that if they're convincing the other gods that they need them to be relevant and therefore are voluntarily surrendering power, and again, if belief is a driving force in this universe, you know, with tangible results, well, then if they believe that they are subordinate to the new gods, and if they believe they need the new gods, then does that become the reality? Or is that a way the new gods have of controlling them? But again, but just controlling them through a... through trickery, by making them believe that they're controlled. Sort of like, you know, the original Nightmare on Elm Street. And, you know, that realizing that your dreams only don't have any power over you except what you give them. And therefore, Freddy didn't really have the power over them. They gave him the power to destroy him, in which he realizes that the movie ends, right? She, spoiler warning, Nancy awakens from her dream and all is well again until, of course, the surprise twist. But that's not necessarily a completely new idea, but it's a way to do it with this. I'm wondering if that made, because remember, we saw that. Why is it they weren't? Why didn't they not just take out Odin directly? Why were they trying to seduce him and recruit him? You know, did he have a power over them that they didn't realize, or maybe they're not as strong as they pretend to be?
Yeah. Okay. So it could even be something like a demigod versus a real god, in a sense. You know, the real gods have much more power than a demigod and technology and whatever. Maybe they're, you're right. Maybe they just don't have the same power as the old gods. And as we know with technology, especially in the past 20 years or so, or if you really want to go back to, say, you know, 1880 with the industrial age going forward, the changes that are happening and they're just going faster and faster, the technology gods will be irrelevant tomorrow. You know, I mean, maybe there was a floppy disk and a VCR god just, you know, 20 years ago, and now they're extinct because now you have thumb drive god and,
right.
You know, so.
Well, remember second season of Game of Thrones, the power puzzle, the, you know, where does the power reside? What was the choice that the.
Yeah, it's wherever.
Wherever the people believe it is, and yeah. So it seems to me that the media gods, the new gods, are trying to convince the old gods that they have the power. And as long as people believe they have the power, then they will have the power. The problem is, of course, is that it's an illusion. And if they stop believing that, right? If people put their fucking phones down,
yep.
If people turn their TVs off,
yep.
Then they don't have any power.
Right.
Whereas if you're talking about spring. Right, the power of fertility, the power of the harvest, that's something you can't put down. That's not something you can turn off. Those are real powers, real things ingrained into our survival, necessary for our survival.
Right. Yeah, they're no choice because they just happen.
And yeah, and if you really think of it, you know, again, something I've always said or long said is that we are a species built on storytelling. Stories are vitally important. And in this world, so Nancy is a god of stories, And media really is just a vehicle for delivering stories. So really, they should be subordinate to that, right? I mean...
Right. Well, and I wouldn't even... This is why this show is more really just an allegory than anything else, or a commentary by Neil Gaiman about something. Again, we haven't read the books to know exactly yet, but, is there a books have been around for years, so is there a book god, or is there a fisherman god? Yeah, you know, you can go on and on, and none of them are really gods because they're just activities, you know, they're just items of importance, you know, like the military is important, but there's no god that's the military, even if people love the military for whatever reasons, for patriotism or whatever. So
well, that would be a you know, probably where you'd get a war god, and certainly you could understand where in the modern world you would have a god of internet porn, right? Or a god of guns in our world, you would also expect a god of video games, and you know, and all sorts of different things in all different formats. And
well, and that, that's but, so where yes, I but think that's where I think the allegory comes in, Mike, because
absolutely
there is no gods for those things, because no one worships them and has temples with them. It's all just allegorical, and that's what I think Neil Gaiman must be trying to say here, because that's completely different than even if Odin and Bisquick are all extinct as gods, and everybody knows that they never existed and it was just made up stories. At one time, they did have temples and people, priestesses and whatever, but there's never ever been a temple or a priestess, a real, you know, as in what we would expect for religion anyway, for these allegory gods that we're talking about, which are the new gods, I guess, or even things like books that have been around for years, because you could assume if he really wanted to and make a comment on books, he could have made a god of books, you know?
Right.
I don't know. So, I mean, yeah, it is curious. It's interesting. Maybe these gods are more, these new gods are similar to like the Grim Reaper or Death or something like that, you know, that we've seen in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Story or something, you know, so they have some power, but, and they exist for whatever reason, but they're not, you know, no one has a temple to the Grim Reaper, you know what I mean? Unless you're weird.
Well, and this is part of the problem of this story and this world. And again, I'm having a lot of fun watching these characters and enjoying them and watching it slowly unravel, but the key here is going to be slowly. And, you know, you don't have the rules of the universe, I think, clearly established. I'm not completely clear on I know who the nominal villains are the, in terms of who they are as characters, but what is their desire? What is their motivation? What is their power and abilities? What is their grand scheme? And okay,
are they really villains, or are they just the nominal people that were not following? In other words, the people we're following are Shadow and those around him. So obviously, we're going to sympathize with them over the new gods. Had Neil Gaiman wrote a different story, we could have been sympathizing with the
right. And but even that, I'm not concerned with, because we're dealing with our point of view characters at the moment. But at the very least, our characters should know, oh, we are against these people for this reason, and because they want to do this, and this is their goal. So we should at least be on their side. Well, and we could find out the opposite side, what their point of view is later in the series. But at least let's get a rough idea of what we're going against and why we're going against them. And we're sort of doing this rush to war without knowing any of that. And maybe that's, I don't know if that's part of the commentary. And certainly Odin as a war god is trying to get us to go to war and trying to get his people going to war. But why? What is his problem with the new gods? He's been existing as a marginal deity for centuries now.
Right.
Are those deities, we have not seen any sign so far that they have any desire to actively force him out. They had offered him an opportunity to stay, but that would not appear to be an act of hostility. He chose to turn down their deal and was probably right not to trust their deal. But exactly what is it that they're doing that has, you know, a bee in his boxers, right? So why is he so, you know, determined to take them down? And more importantly, why is he so determined to take them down now? And to the point where he's manipulating Shadow and murdering his wife and all this in order to achieve that. What's happening? And this is where parameters and giving... You're not saying everything has to be laid out black and white, but we should have an understanding of what the borders of the playground are and what the rules of the game are. And we don't. I'm perfectly happy not knowing that Odin is necessarily a good guy or a bad guy, and same thing with the new gods. But what are the battle lines? And what's the motivation?
Yeah, we did get a little more clarification of Odin now, because where we left off last week, it seemed like he was a really bad guy. But based off of what we learned this week, it wasn't specifically for evil things. It was more to have a character become alienated and alone in the world, and therefore apt to be a person to get on there to join his side. And so he killed off Lara and had Shadow go to Jill, because it's part of a way gods get people to join them. And it makes sense because, you know, when you're at your lowest, you're more apt to believe. You know, I mean, we've seen so many times, or at least I have, where people have been very low or depressed, and you know, they become suddenly join a church, and it helps them, and it makes them feel better. Some of them, it actually makes their life better, while others, as we know, get sucked into cults. But generally, when you're at your low, you're more apt to, you know, believe or go to churches or whatever. So something about Shadow, which we still don't know exactly, is important. And by getting him to be lost in the world and alone, Odin was apt to get him to, if not necessarily believe right away, at least be a somewhat fringe follower or something. At least that's what I get out of it.
The gods, and Odin says this in the episode, right? It's like the gods have been fucking around with people for their own amusement forever. That's what gods do. So if we want to judge Wednesday by mortal standards, and there's no reason we can't, he's a dick because he killed Laura to manipulate Shadow into becoming a follower he can manipulate. But from the point of view of a god, here's a guy who's been around for thousands of years. What is Laura to him? One more gnat who's going to pass away while he still has centuries and millennia ahead of him. She's next to nothing. And so, and we certainly see this again, the theme of sacrifice from last episode or two episodes ago. People get sacrificed, things get sacrificed to the gods. And so she's just sort of one more sacrifice to give them power.
They actually even say she was a sacrifice. Sweeney Todd says she's a sacrifice.
Matt Sweeney.
That's what I meant to say. I keep on saying that. Yeah, Matt Sweeney said that. Yep. Yeah. And makes sense. It makes sense. Also, we did learn in this episode that Matt Sweeney is not a god. Lara brings this up and says, because there's a scene we'll discuss in a little bit about why a certain person can't resurrect her because a god supposedly killed her. And she says, yeah, but you're not a god. And then Sweeney Todd admits that, yeah, being a leprechaun is not a... Matt Sweeney admits that he is not a god. However, he was acting in the behest of another god, which happened to be Odin. So we did learn a few extra little things that were quirky, or at least I felt were quirky, and that I mentioned when we were discussing in prior episodes. So I thought that was at least satisfactory to learn. All right. So what else generally did you want to bring up, or did you want to start discussing more scenes since we already went through the BizQuick stuff?
Yeah. We could just keep going from there. I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah.
We cut to... we go from there to them. I'm trying to remember.
They run over the rabbits.
Well, right. So them arriving at and driving to Easter's compound, her home.
It's like in Kentucky, I think.
It's in Kentucky. Yeah. And they go to visit her to recruit her. And so, we see all the pictures of all the, the grounds are covered in rabbits. It's supposed to be Easter Sunday. Lots of obvious Easter imagery with colored eggs and bunny rabbits and whatnot. So they drive over the bunnies to get there.
Yeah, it was surprising. I'm not sure why he did that, because it seemed like he was excited to see her, but he seemed like he also did it from like a malevolent or sociopathic reasons too. So this is Wednesday we're talking about.
Yes.
So
more hints that he's a bit of a prick.
Yeah. Right. Because he wasn't going there for revenge or anything like that. So it was just because he was a prick, as you mentioned. And sure enough, it's Easter Sunday, I guess, right? I mean, this is supposed to be the day of Easter itself. And so there's a big celebration going on there. So, like a lot of folks, they have parties at their house with family and friends and whatnot for celebration of Easter, whether it's they're religious or whether they just do it as a general holiday for non-religious reasons. And being a wealthy person, as Ostara is, it's a mansion, and she has like hundreds of people here, so it's a humongous estate. And it's a little different than a regular Easter celebration where people sit down and spend time with 5 to 15 people. I mean, here it's like a martini type event, I would say.
Right. It's just, absolutely. They have a serious Jesus infestation.
Yeah. I've never thought I would ever see stuff like this on TV, but I had started seeing it with the television show Supernatural, where they used the gods, Christian and Judeo-Christian traditions, and actually integrate them into stories that I could see some people actually finding, if not offensive, at least somewhat unappealing. And again, Supernatural was the first that I had ever seen such a thing happen. Maybe it's happened in the past prior to that. And this, I think, is probably the second time I've ever seen something like that. And it was a bit surprising. And I did watch the little vignette by the showrunners afterwards, and read about the actress later. But the woman who plays Ostara is a Christian fundamentalist, I think, or some very, very religious Christian. And they felt it was a bit ironic that they cast her in a role in a television show that some folks may find a bit, if not offensive, a bit shocking for their portrayal of Christianity or Judeo-Christian beliefs, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's the changing face of the media. Because you go back to when we were kids and you had, your three networks or five networks, whatever you had.
And we had, what's that, Sam and Goliath, the... Thanks,
oh, Davey Goliath, yeah.
Thanks, Davey.
Davey, yes.
Yeah.
And, well, when the United States was, I think even now it's still 70% Christian.
Right.
And even then it was probably closer to 90%. You're getting an increase in non-denominational atheist or agnostic in recent years. We still have a very heavily Christian nation. Or even if it's just the what we call like the cafeteria Catholics, or the those who only go to church on twice a year on Easter Sunday and Christmas, but you still have people who identify that way. But you had to appeal to the largest number of people possible, so you could not offend anybody. or you had to avoid offending the a large number of people. And so playing around with someone's religious figures was a way to really piss a lot of people off. So you weren't going to see a lot of that on shows. And obviously it's an easy mark now in a lot of ways, but people are criticizing certain religious faiths. We know people will get upset with it. Some will respond by writing angry letters. Some will respond by shooting up offices, but people don't respond well to it. So it's a way to get attention. And now because the media is so fragmented, you're not looking at trying to grab that, 90% of the market anymore. That's impossible, but you can survive where you wouldn't on just capturing the attention of that small 10 or 15% that would be interested in something like this on whatever it may be. So, and if 70% of the country is offended, who cares? Because if you get 30% of the country watching, you're going to be the biggest show on television right now.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a good observation, Mike. Oddly though, it's still a bit surprising, even for someone who's fairly open or middle of the road to a lot of points of view. I'm actually quite surprised and shocked that they were able to. Not able to get away with it, because I believe they're able to get away with it, but surprised and shocked that they would want to get away with it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I would probably not have thought of writing something of like this. you know what I'm talking about? So it's just curious.
Well, again, I think part of it's a matter of our age and our generation, or is that we weren't expected. I think you look at the genie scene in the hotel room. That's something that I don't think I'd ever expected to see something like that on television outside of a softcore porn or something. It's just
pay-per-view nudie shows or something.
Right, but society, things have changed, and there's things that they can do now that I never thought they would have been able to do. Good. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. It just is, and so it's just. And in some ways, I'm glad for it. In some cases, they tell stories I'm not interested in, but I don't have to watch those. I've got other stories I can. But I think that's the advantage of choice, and that's what I like about that.
Right, right. And it's the advantage of choice that you're able to write something like this that me or you may not necessarily be offended by, but I could see some of my more religious friends probably be most certainly offended by, and that's what I think is interesting anyway. But either way, I guess all I'm trying to say is that I would not consider writing or doing something like this, but it appears that other folks are, and I guess like you said. If you don't like it, don't watch it. So, let's discuss about this. So that theme earlier in the show, which seemed just like a throwaway line way back, which is, the Mexican Jesus or the American Jesus or the French Jesus or whatever Jesus, actually turns out to be not a throwaway line at all. And since this is Easter and the celebration of Easter with supernatural beings or gods, if you prefer, and since Jesus exists based off of ethnicity and race rather than a Bible, it appears, there's multiple Jesus here. There's like hundreds of them. Oh, no, there's 15 is what the showrunner said at their vignette interview at the end after the credits. So there's 15 Jesus present.
Okay. And well, they do say in the episode that there's one Jesus for every denomination.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that means you can have relatively minor variations in Jesus, or rather significant differences in your interpretation of Jesus. But there's a whole lot of Jesuses.
Right. And that makes sense, because the difference between what people do and say based off of their religious beliefs versus what is actually in the Bible and who Jesus is are completely different things, right? I mean, you know, we've the Crusades, people are doing things in the name of Jesus. The West Baptist Church does things in the name of Jesus. You know, you can go on and on what people do in the name of Jesus, and yet Jesus is long gone now, passed away. And I'm sure if he saw all these interpretations and what people do in his name, he would probably be horrified, because everything based off of what I've read, being a Catholic and being in CCD as you had been too, Mike, Jesus was nothing like any of the things that a lot of people claim he was. So this is really more the interpretation of what people claim he was, meaning that he exists because of what people say or believe, rather than actually what was written or his real life was 2,000 years ago.
Right.
And I think that has to be stated just for that fact. Because yeah, you're right. Because, I mean, why would there be a Mexican Jesus or every denominational Jesus when the Bible says there's just one Jesus and it's written there and you can just read that and that's Jesus? You know, it's like there's not 20 different George Washingtons or 20 different Mao Zedongs, right? There's just one and they're written about and we know who they are and we know what they did, whether it was good or bad. So here it's more of a belief system rather than the factual history, I guess.
Right. Well, again, it's who gets believed into existence and who doesn't. I mean, you could argue that the reason that there's only one George Washington is because he was real and he didn't have to be willed into existence. And even so, even now, everyone kind of, whatever they believe about him, they all are pretty damn sure he's dead.
So. Well, that's why I went with that big preamble that I was talking about, because a lot of people, there was only one Jesus and a lot of people say he was alive and he did exist too. And so all these other Jesuses that are portrayed in this television show aren't the real Jesus of history and what was written in, you know, the St. James Bible, for example.
Well, we've said this many times on the Dark Discussions podcast, is the old saying that you have to buy the premise to buy the bit. You either buy the premise that gods can be summoned into existence by people's will and people's belief, or you don't. And if you can't, you can't enjoy the show. If you can, then you at least are meeting the show halfway. And if you're going to say, well, I'll believe that they can summon Odin, and they can summon Easter, and they can summon Anansi, and you can create a new god out of media and technology, but I can't believe, you know, a couple billion people in the world believing in Jesus can't summon a forth various different versions of Jesus, I won't go there. Well, then you're never going to be able to meet the show halfway, because that's the whole premise of the show.
Yeah, and that's an excellent observation, Mike, because, again, as we discussed earlier, why is there a cell phone Jesus, I mean, a cell phone God and a media God, but there's no, you know, book God, right? I mean, again, it's an allegory, and it's a suspension of disbelief, and you got to go with it, because if you can't go with it, then it's no good. In other words, like my wife, she doesn't believe in science fiction, she doesn't believe in ghosts, she doesn't believe in spacemen, she doesn't believe in all that stuff, so she can't enjoy any horror films unless they're serial killers or parasite virus films, you know. So if I show her Star Trek, she'll go, this is stupid, this doesn't happen. If I show her The Exorcist, she goes, this is stupid, this can't happen. But if I show her 28 Days Later or Silence of the Lambs, she could get into it, because those are more and you know, it's easier for suspension of disbelief for her. So again, I guess what we're really trying to say, again, though, it probably doesn't matter, because most people who are listening to this podcast are probably at least enjoying some of the show, because otherwise they would have tuned out by now.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, if you're making a Superman movie, you're not going to have to explain, you don't have to spend, you know, 45 minutes convincing the audience that a person from the planet Krypton will be super strong and can fly and will run around a fictional city wearing his underwear on the outside and a cape because people walked in there to see a freaking Superman movie. If they can't handle that, they wouldn't have gone to see it.
Excellent point. Yep, excellent point. All right, so that let's move on to this now. This party, right? I mean, basically the whole episode after the Billquist and the 5 minutes it takes Wednesday and Shadow to get to Ostara's estate is really all at Ostara's estate.
Yes.
So hey, go on.
I'm sorry, I was jumping ahead, so I don't want to get to that yet.
Oh, continue. Okay. All right, so let's talk about other things we see here. All right, so we see that there's a bunch of Jesuses. We learn through Wednesday and Ostara, which is just a Germanic version of the word Easter, I think, because Ostara was a goddess, old German goddess from a long time ago, obviously. And how Wednesday is saying that you exist, or you're able to keep your power, even if it's not what it used to be, because you were basically able to hook your existence to the Christianity. So your day, which is Easter Day, is now being used by Christians or those folks who believe in the various types of Jesuses, and therefore you can still survive and be powerful because you are relevant, because you are relevant to a more powerful God, which happens to be the Jesuses, I guess. I guess that's what the premise is, at least.
Well, it's that in part, and it's also the that Easter has an alliance with media.
Okay.
Right, because that there's the Easter, the media, the bunnies, the Cadbury bunny and the jelly beans and all the rest. And she makes a comment that this is the same deal we made with Saint Nick.
Yeah, that was a good one, yeah.
So it's the idea that that's the commercialization of the holiday. That nobody's gonna remember what the holiday is really about. Whether it's because they believe it's about Jesus or because they believe it's about bunnies and Easter eggs and it's not about fertility. And we should point out, I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of this, that when Christianity was spreading, one of the ways to help spread Christianity was by usurping the holidays of other cultures.
Right, of the pagans.
Right, so like Christmas, we know that Jesus was not born on December 25th. We know he was probably born sometime in the spring, but the pagan holidays were around that time, so that just made it convenient, right, to put that and say, oh, sure, well, celebrate this party that you do every year, the rebirth, the renewal, because it follows right as the days are starting to get longer again, and we'll just do it as a time to celebrate the birth of our Lord, because at the time they really didn't necessarily know when exactly that happened.
You mean the resurrection of the Lord?
No, with Christmas.
Right.
So, because Christmas happens like right after the shortest day of the year, and so the sunlight starts getting longer and longer after that.
Oh, I see your reference now. You're right. Yeah, I was confused when you say the days were getting brighter, and I'm thinking, I don't know, it's dead of winter. But you're right. The first day of winter
is just a couple of days before Christmas, the 21st or 22nd, depending on
where you live, and that day is the dark, the shortest day of the year. And then as each day goes forward, it begins to get brighter and brighter. And so, so you're right. That's a fair point. And so here, the same thing, where there was some sort of holiday, the equinox or this Ostara's rebirth holiday in pagan days. And then what happens is Jesus, the Christians take that day and use it and merge it with the resurrection of Christ. And Odin actually mentions that by saying it's not really the resurrection of Christ today. It's a month earlier, but you know, a day is a day, who cares? He doesn't say it in those words, but he pretty much implies it. And that's basically what you're saying, Mike, which is merging an old pagan holiday with the real holiday and making it the same.
Right.
And as we've come to modern era, meaning today, it's become commercialized now and is now linked to, as you said, technology in many ways, from TV to blogs to whatever. So, and even churches now have websites. So,
yep.
So it's a I think even the Pope and Iranian Mullah and whatever, they all have Twitter accounts now.
Well, and all right, you know, I'm going to pull something. I hope I'm not going to piss people off. I know you're a dog person, but like you just had, you know, for years the doctrine of the Catholic Church was that people die, people go to heaven. Cats and dogs, they're not people. They don't have souls. They die. They die. Even though people will tell their kids, there's a doggy heaven and there's a kitty heaven and whatever.
Right, right. My father's dog just passed away a couple of months ago, and I told my daughters that Roser is now with Jesus.
Right, and so now Pope Francis said a couple of days ago, no, dogs can go to heaven. I don't know that he said anything about cats. I think he said dogs can go to heaven. Maybe he said dogs and cats can go to heaven.
Yeah, I think he said all animals, actually.
Because in the end, you're talking, well, you know, people are not going to want to hear a church that tells them that their doggy and their kitty won't go to heaven, especially not when you're talking about a country like the United States, where there's an awful lot of people who are choosing to have cats and dogs instead of having children. You're losing out on an audience. So, and this is not just to single out the Catholic Church. Most churches do this, right? Which is that they find their audience. They realize they have to sometimes change their message to appeal to their audience, to keep their followers.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the Unitarians have already been saying that animals had souls long, long ago. So, and they're Christians too. So yeah, it's whatever helps people and brings them in. You could argue that it's a marketing tool, or you could argue it's an actual reinterpretation. Either way, it's something of note because it's a change in an opinion.
Well, even something like fundamentalist Christianity is not really that old. That was a thing where they said, where again, it's appealing to a particular group of people. Not that it was necessarily insincere, but it was a group of people who said, we don't like how the church has changed, and we want a back to basics, back to the original.
Right.
And, you know, and we see that, right? We saw, like, you know, it's like a James Bond movie, right? You know, you get Die Another Day, it goes way haywire with CGI and over the top, and they said, well, hold on, we've got to go back to fundamentalist Bond and do Casino Royale, you know, and go back to the books, go back to the novel. And that's sort of what happened with fundamentalist
right.
Christianity, is they said, let's go back to the book, and let's stick with the book. And that appealed to a particular audience, and that group of Christians speaks to that group of Christians. That's their audience, and they're going to keep sticking to that because it works for them and appeals to their followers, and other churches will do what they have to appeal to their own followers, like the Catholics deciding that kitties and doggies and goldfish get to go to heaven now.
Right, right. Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair. And a lot of folks who aren't necessarily from the States, the history of Christianity in the States is fairly different than Europe, for the fact that, or anywhere in the world, for the fact that a lot of the Protestant religions appear to have been created in the United States within the past 170 years, like the Methodists and other religions like Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses, on and on and on. And everybody thinks those are old and ancient religions, and they are, in the sense that they are quote unquote Christian, but they are not old and ancient religions by any means. They are new religions within the last 150 to 170 years. So it is curious, and you're absolutely right. It comes down to a certain base of people and what they want to interpret or believe that makes them feel best in their definition of Christianity, and then suddenly, poof, you get the Methodists appear, you know, and so poof, you suddenly get the Pope saying that animals do have souls and do go to heaven. So, yeah, I mean, it is curious, and I guess this is really just an extension of prior stuff like Easter now being used as the resurrection of Christ. And I think that's one of the things that's important about this episode, because they show Shadow seeing all these versions of Christ, and him actually even discussing and talking to a couple of them. And they do have a funny joke, too, where one Christ is sitting on water, you know, like Jesus walks on water, and then when he puts his cup down, it sinks. And he's upset because he can't drink his beverage now because it sinks to the bottom of the pool. But he can float, but his drink can't.
And there's some people, and my mother was one of those, that's blasphemy. Don't do that. And it's like, I always thought that, you know, if anything, God invented humor. So I would hope that he had to have a sense of humor about things.
Yeah, yeah. I it was shocking when I saw all this. Honestly, because again, I've never seen any of this, and maybe it's just my generation. But you're right. I mean, it's a little sense of humor, and I'm not going to take it as anything but that and not be offended. And it was kind of funny too. I did get a little chuckle. But the thing that I think shocked me more than that was when he says, "God damn it." Or something like that. It was kind of funny.
Well, and did you make the point that Jesus isn't a god? He's a son of a god.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Well, depending on your version of Christianity, the son of God is the same for Catholicism. God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost are one and the same. Just three versions of God, of the same one God. So it depends on I guess your perspective.
Anyway, then I think enough for theology.
Yeah. I mean, this whole episode, you could probably do that. But again, I think this is really just an allegory of gods become powerful or exist only because of people. And I think that's where we're going here.
Right. And I think you could take then the allegory a step and say that what this is really saying, if you, and again, who knows where it's going to end up, but maybe they're really talking not about the gods, but about the church, right? About the religions, because the religions change according to what their followers want, and they appeal specifically to the followers. And you need the followers and the believers for the church to exist, and the church is different from God or Jesus or Allah or Muhammad or Jehovah or whomever it is, or Buddha, whoever it is you worship. The religion is separate from them. It's an interpretation of them.
Right. That's an excellent point. I think that was one of the smartest things said tonight, too, because that's exactly what I've been trying to say without getting the words out correctly, which is the church is different than the God itself.
Right.
So basically, Wednesday wants to get Ostara as his queen, whatever that means. At least he wants her to join his side, basically. And so he's trying to use his marketing, which is, yeah, you can have all this. You're second to Jesus or the many Jesuses, because it's really his day. Your day. You're just now hanging on. And whatever the new gods are trying to tell you with the TVs and promoting you on TV and through Hallmark cards and whatever is still not like your heyday, you know, from 2,500 years ago when people worshipped you, had temples to you, had priestesses and priests to you. You know, you exist only because you're, a bunch of bunnies candy for kids, basically.
Right.
And so she's kind of having doubts and saying, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe even though I'm this is a good life, you know, maybe it was better then, but at least I adapted and I still have a good life, is her defense, I guess.
Yeah, and he's wooing her in a lot of the ways he was wooing the sisters in
Chicago. Yeah,
and she's back in Chicago, right? He's just flattering them and appealing to them, and he's, you know, talking about how great she was, and he's basically flattering her because of who she was, and contrasting that to who she's become, and in doing so, trying to, you know, get her ire up without being the one to make her angry.
Right. Exactly. Yep.
And now, I believe is Dulora and Sweeney show up first or next?
No. Yeah. They showed up after Shadow was there, because that's how they found her. Find Shadow and Wednesdays, because she, even though we don't see her perspective until we get to the estate, she has been following the glow in the distance that is Shadow. And so when they get to the estate, Sweeney asks her, how do you know Shadow's here? And then we see through her eyes, which are now becoming like colorblind because, you know, she's a corpse and rotting away. She says, I just know he's here. And then her perspective shows this brilliant glow on the other behind the building. So they come after Shadow and Wednesday have arrived. And they come like halfway through the episode, I think.
Yes. And this was interesting because I was assuming that they were going to try to get Jesus to resurrect her. In fact, they were trying to get Easter to resurrect her.
Yeah, I was quite surprised too. But honestly, it makes sense because if folks who, you know, I mean, you and me are Catholics and we know how it was. Jesus was resurrected by God.
But he also resurrected Lazarus.
Yeah. So that's a fair point too. So yeah, never mind. My analogy doesn't really work.
But it makes sense. She's a goddess of rebirth, so I guess that kind of makes sense. And that's where she says she can't bring her back because she was killed by a god. And that's where it comes out that he killed her, and he did it for Wednesday.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah, and that's also where we find out that Sweeney isn't a god either, because he admits that. Because she goes, yeah, but if you killed me, you're not a god. And then he admits, well, I did it for someone. I was recruited. And then he admits that it's Wednesday. So that's unfortunate for her, at least at this point. Anything else that of significance between those two story points until we get to the end? Because a lot of it is really just a montage without the music of little comedy bits of, you know, all the multiple Jesuses and the rabbits and all this other stuff. And between Wednesday getting her to think, yeah, maybe I should go back to the heyday and this isn't the life I want. And then, of course, the scene where Laura and Sweeney come and they are told that the truth. So after that, is there anything else, or is it really the only other important thing is the ending itself?
Yeah, pretty much. We just see that she's continuing to decay. She's vomiting up maggots. And then they have that little exchange. They give us the vital information, and at that point, media and technology boys show up to the party.
Right, right. I did read something interesting. Media shows up as Judy Garland this time.
Right,
and which is interesting because on Easter weekend I visited my father, and the TV in the background was playing the movie Easter Parade, which stars Judy Garland and Fred Astaire, and this version of media is the Judy Garland from the movie Easter Parade. So it's a very obscure reference. I'm sure in the book it probably explains everything, that Judy Garland shows up as she was dressed in the movie Easter Parade. But for us, the only way we would have known that is if you were lucky like me and the movie was on in the background during Easter, or if you went on a blog and read about it. So the show continues to have things in it that the layman would never get, because otherwise she doesn't really look like Judy Garland.
No, she actually looked more like David Bowie, probably. So.
You know, yeah. So, I mean, she was dressed like Judy Garland was in the film, but she didn't look like Judy Garland. You know, I mean, it wasn't, the makeup job wasn't as good as, say, when she was David Bowie or Marilyn Monroe. And to be honest, I didn't even know that she was David Bowie when she was, looking like David Bowie at that time. I think they probably would have been better off if they had done an actress, different actresses for each interpretation of media, you know, or male, because it appears she can be cross-gender. But of course, they wanted the big name, and Gillian Anderson's a big name. But if they wanted to be true to the book without getting a big name actor or actress, they could have had a different actor play the same character in each scene. But I guess that's just a nitpick. But either way, it was supposed to be Judy Garland from the movie Easter Parade.
Which I do know of the film. I kind of suspected that's what it is. I've never actually watched it, or at least if I did, I would have been really, really young, and while it was like probably on the background while my parents were watching it. Mm-hmm. Yep. But yeah, that is kind of a deep cut for modern audiences.
Yeah, yeah. Especially, I mean, I bet you, this is just a complete conjecture, but the book says Judy Garland from the movie Easter Parade, assuming this scene is actually in the book, because as we know with books, they can do that. But here, you know, since it's a show or audio video media, you're not going to get that. And like you said, it's a very deep cut. So they all show up, media, Tech Boy, and World, Mr. World. And it appears that those are the only three modern gods, I guess. I don't know if the book has more, or we'll be introduced with more in season two and possibly three, as Sean Quinn Robinson mentioned. But so far, there's really only three modern gods.
Right. And they seem to be co-opting other old gods, like they try to do with Easter here. And this is where you see the words that Wednesday was pouring in her ear earlier are starting to come out, because now she's realizing, wait a minute, I'm being kind of taken advantage of here. I'm being overlooked. I am not what I was, because right. I'm being subordinate sort of to media.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. She doesn't blame Jesus. She blames media. And I thought that was pretty cool, because it really is the new gods that are screwing her over even more so than Jesus. Because it's the new gods who have turned her into a parody.
Right, and she makes the comment that I don't like the way I'm being portrayed in the media, and, you know, says it with a little bit of a stab in the ribs, right? You know, says it with a poke in her voice, aimed at Gillian Anderson.
Right.
Judy Garland.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's kind of what puts her and shows her, again, the idea that you need a queen, shows her as a powerful pivot point, and they bring in the gentleman, the faceless men.
Right, right, which we saw with when Tech Boy lynched Shadow.
Right, I was a little surprised. It almost felt like it was going to break into a musical number, right? Because they come out, and they're dressed in their Sunday best.
Right, they were almost like the Fred Astaire from Easter Parade,
right?
But without being Fred Astaire,
right? And they keep multiplying, and they sort of like surround them. And it's interesting because Easter Parade obviously is a musical. You have Kristen Chenoweth who plays Easter, is a well known Broadway actress. She got was Tony Award nominated for playing Glinda in Wicked, and she's was on Glee, and she was on Pushing Daisies.
That's how she probably got this role, is because she knew the showrunners from Pushing Daisies.
And in Pushing Daisies, she sang like every two or three episodes, she would sing a song.
Was she a main cast member to that show?
Yes.
Okay.
She was like a supporting role, but she was in every episode.
Sure.
So you are building up to this, and then they're all struck down by lightning. You know, it's just...
Yeah, Odin kills them all.
Right, and this is basically where he reveals who he is to Shadow Moon, which, again, I got to apologize. I didn't realize this was supposed to be a big secret. You know, it's sort of like, I am Odin! Yeah, we know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I'm actually, a lot of people who probably watch this show are probably saying, who the hell is Odin?
Yeah, that's the other problem.
Yeah, exactly. And we also learned that Shadow is a nickname, not his real Christian name, because Shadow was what people called him because he used to shadow his mother everywhere.
Right. And that makes me wonder if there's going to be a revelation as to what his real name is.
Right. Going forward, yeah. And again, he's half Norwegian because his father was supposed to be Norwegian. So that's probably why Odin, and you made a good observation that could be a possibility, is that maybe Odin is, you know, the father, but we'll find that out sooner or later. And the reason Norwegian is important is because Odin is a Teutonic god, and Norway is part of the Teutonic nations.
What's interesting is we did see with Bilquis, right, that Bilquis fell so far that she forgot she was a god.
Yeah, you're right. Or goddess, or right. Yeah, exactly.
Goddess, right. So, I don't know, that opens up the door to maybe Shadow having a whole backstory that we don't know about.
Yeah.
And that he doesn't even know about.
Right. Right. Yeah. So Odin basically declares war when he strikes down these faceless men, I guess, and wounds Mr. World. And then he talks Easter into showing her power and getting out of the farce that Austera has become. And so she ends spring. Is basically what I read, because I still wasn't sure exactly what she did. So when I was reading the wiki this evening, it said that she basically takes away spring.
Right, she takes away it says make them pray for it, right, because they talk about people used to pray because they starved, right, fasting for Lent, right, because if you're Catholic, then starting on Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras Day, 40 days before Lent, before Easter, rather, you're supposed to give something up. And now it's, I'll give up chocolate, or I'll give up peanut butter, where it used to be you would fast for 40 days. And they make the point that people fasted for 40 days because it was the end of fucking winter and there was no more food. You know?
And
so they prayed to get spring back, right? And they forced them into it. So make them pray again, right? Starve the fuckers. And so she's taking away the food. And again, this is why, I get that this is supposed to be a season cliffhanger, but it still feels more to me like it would be leading into the real ultimate episode of the season. Like there should have been one more episode to follow this one.
This should have been the penultimate episode. Is that the word? How do you say it?
It's the penultimate. Would be the one before the last. So, and you know, I'm not saying I'm certainly going to tune in. I was going to tune in episode 2.1 anyway. But it's sort of like, okay, we're getting going. We're getting, now we're stopping. And I just wish we had that one more show.
Right. Well, and you know, Mike, it's curious because, you know, Bates Motel is a pretty good show. Colony is a pretty good show. The Strained is a pretty good show. Obviously, Walking Dead is a pretty good show. But a lot of these shows, even Supernatural, but a lot of these shows, when they have these hiatuses, some people never go back. And I saw season one of Colony, and I didn't go back to season two, and not because I didn't like it. It's just that, you know, I knew things happened, and the show didn't overwhelm me to the point like Game of Thrones, where I said, oh, I got to watch it. So, and I know you like the show, you've seen it. And same with Strain, and same with Walking Dead, and same with Bates Motel, and same with Hannibal, and, you know, on and on. So this show, based off of what I've seen, and especially with this type of quote-unquote cliffhanger, I could see a lot of people, you know, forgetting that this show even exists when it comes back, you know, in 12 months from now.
Well, and that's the thing, right? You have to, with Game of Thrones, it's an event.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
With Walking Dead, whether you like it or not,
they made it an event.
Right. And, you know, people may not have liked how they did it in the last season, or they may have, but they do turn it into water cooler talk. They've done something that people thought was never happening again, which was getting people to find a show to talk about. And right. It's, oh, look who died. Who do you think will die?
Well, it might
even happen next.
Even more important than that, they actually have made Game of Thrones and Walking Dead 2. I guess, though I don't really watch that show anymore, into a show that people go to bars or
right, exactly,
or clubs, to not just talk about it, but go to bars and watch the show
right.
At the bars like they would watch Monday Night Football. You know, so it's an event, never mind just something to talk about the next day.
See, know? Like, I thought it was funny watching the season finale of Bates Motel, and I really like Bates Motel, and I strongly recommend it. I think it gets better for the most part as it goes along, and it starts out pretty good and ends up being a really, really solid show. It's much better than it ever had any right to be. But then they do their little wrap up show, because the after shows now are a big thing, because you have The Talking Dead after Walking Dead, so they do their own little after show for the last episode of Bates Motel. And sort of a farewell episode, and they talk about all the fandom that's built up around Bates Motel, which I kind of looked down and went, oh, I didn't know that. It's hard to miss it with Walking Dead. It's hard to miss it with Game of Thrones.
Yep.
Everything has its own little bit of fandom, and you could find a handful of fans here or there. And not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with the fandom of Bates Motel, or whatever fandom there will be for or is right now for American Gods.
But it's a niche.
But it's a small niche. And even, look, even the fandom for Game of Thrones and Walking Dead is a niche. It's just they're a much larger niche than the other ones are. But you are in a culture now where 12 million viewers is the top-rated show, where 30 years ago, 12 million viewers in a much smaller population would have been canceled,
yeah.
Right? Because that just wasn't enough. So niches are what it is. It's who's got the biggest niche. You know, that's sort of what kicks into the popular consciousness. It's going to get what, you know, people make jokes about on late night TV.
Right, right. No,
you don't get like you remember when we were probably been about 10 years old, Who Shot JR?
Yeah.
Right. That was probably, I could be wrong, is probably the first real big TV cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Because at most shows were originally 26 episodes. All right. As that you do a 26 episode season, you did, that gave you enough time to do half of a year with repeats for another half. And they would always structure it so that the repeats were mostly coming in summer when people were actually out of the house doing things. Or during Christmas season when people were out shopping and celebrating and stuff like that. But they would basically disperse the 26 episodes. And that would get you a full year's worth. And there wasn't – and everything – the idea was anyone should be able to turn on the TV show at any time and join in. And so nobody ever changed. Gilligan never got off the island. And every episode series started off with a theme song that explained to you, if you're a new viewer, what the show is about. So you didn't get – season openings, season endings so much. You just got another chapter.
Right.
And they just would advertise it. Oh, new episodes are back. It's been a summer. It's September. Time for the new shows. Come back and watch the new shows. But it usually wasn't with any big fanfare. Certainly season finales usually weren't that big. Maybe they would have a wedding episode or something, but not a But they do an episode of Dallas, and they shoot the lead character, and the whole summer is who shot him. They don't even leave it as a mystery that he died, because everybody knows he lived, because they weren't that silly. But who shot him, and it turned it into a mystery, and they promised the mystery, and then that sort of turned into a thing, and more shows, and now you have to have something big. Better Call Saul's last season ended with a big mystery, sort of a big event. That I don't want to spoil, but it's everything has something big. And what was it? Game of Thrones, right? Ends with, oh, finally we're getting the characters going to war, and this character is killed, and this, it's all this big stuff happening,
Mike,
in the final episode.
It's even more than that, because a lot of shows don't even need cliffhangers, but if they're so awesome, people will come back even if the ending wasn't a cliffhanger for that episode, or if it was just a minor cliffhanger. You could just have, two people marry, which is okay. That's exciting, whatever, but it's not a cliffhanger. And then they end at the wedding. But if the show is awesome, like Game of Thrones is, or an event or whatever you want to call it, they'll come back. But if in other words, the show doesn't have to necessarily have an awesome cliffhanger. It could just be awesome in itself. And unfortunately, a lot of shows are niche, but they're not awesome. Or they don't have that awesome cliffhanger, because even an awesome cliffhanger can't save a show that's not awesome.
Well, I think there's, and we could split hairs on, like, a cliffhanger originally referred to the idea that you are leaving your hero in jeopardy.
Yep.
And that literally hanging off a cliff, and it was from old movie serials. And how do you bring the audience back? You leave the hero hanging from the cliff. Will he save himself from hanging off the cliff?
Right.
Versus what I would consider, for lack of a better term, like a page turner, which is how do you get the audiences to check in next time? And that could be anything. That could be a big event. There could be a shocking revelation. It doesn't necessarily mean, as with the cliffhanger, that someone's in jeopardy. But the term cliffhanger has kind of come to mean any kind of big event, any kind of big revelation, or any kind of surprise that pops up in that final episode, even though it's really... And I would say, this is the case here, because nobody's in jeopardy here. You just revealed that Odin is Odin, and you had Laura and the Shadow Moon reunited briefly, and we'll kind of see where that goes, but they say... They want us to see what comes next. And I'm curious to see how well they did that with the rest of the viewing audience.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a ditch. So, and there was no, the show, depending on your perspective, it could be awesome. For example, Sean Quinn Robinson thinks it's awesome. But again, I think a lot of the people who are probably watching the show are fans of the book itself, and the book is considered awesome by many. Even if it is a cult book, it's still a fairly important speculative fiction book in the past, whatever amount of years. And so those people who are fans of the book would want to watch the show, you would think, similar to why Game of Thrones probably originally got some notoriety, was because of the fans of the books were happy that it was becoming a show, and then suddenly everybody started watching it because the show is just awesome. So the question is, can American Gods take that next step, or did they do it this season where it's not just a show that people who love the book are watching, but now everybody's watching because it's so awesome? And I don't know if that is the case.
No, and I don't know that, you can sometimes get in a debate about ratings and how much do they matter. They matter because they will get you another season. I want them to be able to finish this story. I don't want them to be able to tell two out of the three chapters, if in fact that's what they're looking at. I don't want them telling two of the three chapters of American Gods and then have to wrap it up with, I don't know, an animated movie or something.
No, and that's a fair point. That's a fair point. And again, I guess... what it reminds me of back before when I was single and dating, there was this girl I met, and she, out of the blue, we were on a date or whatever, and she starts talking about this movie, Witness for the Prosecution, and started to tell me about it. And I go, oh, yeah, I already know about that movie. And she goes, what do you mean? I go, well, I mean, that's the film starring Tyrone Power, Molly Dietrich, Charles Laughton, directed by Billy Wilder. It was written based off of Agatha Christie book, on and on. And she goes, how do you know all that stuff? And I go, oh, I have the disc. She goes, you have the disc? And I go, yeah, why? And in her eyes, it was amazing that this obscure film, I mean, it's not obscure for older generations, but for me and her generation, it was obscure. And I was probably the only person, guy or woman that ever knew of the film besides her parents, probably. And so she adored me because of that. I was like, oh, my God. And she had found somebody who enjoyed something that she liked. And this show here reminds me of that, where the people who are going to come to it are the same folks who are probably listening to this podcast, which is, oh, here's two guys that like something I like. I found something on the internet. Obviously, it's a little easier nowadays. You can find things, you know, by just typing Google. And so they're going to be that niche audience. And so that may be enough, Mike, to, because there's a group of little group of people who love something, and whether or not other people will say, well, this ain't awesome, it won't matter, because you still have this group that thinks it's awesome, and they found other people who thinks it's awesome and know about it, even if, you know, your next door neighbor says, what the hell's American God?
Right. Well, we're also in an age where you could probably get three seasons. Like, you got three seasons out of Penny Dreadful, you got three seasons out of Hannibal. And these are all shows that got a lot of acclaim and that got a dedicated audience, and that they hoped would kind of do what Game of Thrones did, would do what Breaking Bad did, which is start with a small and dedicated audience and build it up.
Yeah, Sons of Anarchy was another one.
Sons of Anarchy is another good example.
Mm-hmm. And it, unfortunately, you know, those only lasted three seasons. And the viewership or cost too much in there as a result, because it was low turnout and expenses. It was axed by the production company and the people who gave them the money. But again, it didn't matter that it had critical praise. A Dexter was another example too. So Dexter was another one. But it's just that what it is, you know, for example, Carnival, which was a pretty damn good show on HBO, died out after, I think, one or two seasons.
Yeah. Same thing with Deadwood is another one, I think, made it two seasons, maybe three.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, Leftovers is another one, you know. Barely made it to three seasons, and the third season is a shortened season. And they're all acclaimed by critics, but for whatever reason, you know, they, you know. And we mentioned, Mike, when The Strain came out, how they were going to try to make that as the next Walking Dead. And whether the show is good or not and people like it, which they appear some folks do. I enjoyed the first couple of seasons. I know you watched the last season and you thought it was pretty damn good. Yet, it never turned out to be The Walking Dead for whatever reason.
Well, because no one ever becomes what they want to become by being the next thing that already has been, right? It's,
yeah.
You're not going to, you know, you get a show like Vikings, which I think is on the air because, History Channel was trying to make a show, and I think they started sometime after Game of Thrones. So I'm wondering if they probably tried to coax Coast on the Game of Thrones vibe, because there were more swords and period pieces. People want period pieces of violence and decadence, and oh, how about Vikings, a show about Vikings? But you're not going to be the next Game of Thrones, because Game of Thrones is Game of Thrones, and people will like Game of Thrones or watching Game of Thrones. You become the next big thing by finding the thing that nobody is doing. And, right, you're not going to find the next Breaking Bad by doing the next Breaking Bad. Nobody was doing Breaking Bad at the time. That's why it became successful.
Right.
Nobody was doing Game of Thrones at the time. That's why it became successful. Nobody was doing Walking Dead at the time, and that helped. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of shows that people aren't doing that flop, because nobody's doing that either, and it's because people aren't interested. It's a matter of just kind of catching the right time in the right place and putting your finger on the pulse and being successful at doing it. And you just have to find your variation on a theme that works.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
like, you know, you can think of back when in the heyday of the sitcom when Friends was a huge hit in the 90s for NBC. Every network had its Friends clones, and there were a lot of them that were successful and a lot of them that ran on for a couple of seasons, but none of them matched the sort of success of Friends.
Right.
They just coasted on its coattails. And when people still talk about Friends now, nobody talks about the other shows that came and went.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So maybe the Game of Thrones is the exception and not the rule. And that's what people got to think of when they look at all these various shows, and now specifically these various speculative fiction shows, I guess. Yep. Even if the source is impressive, you know, because, you know, The Strain was Del Toro, you know, and everybody, quote unquote, loves Del Toro. Or Bates Motel, you know, is based off of Psycho, you know, and this one's here off of Neil Gaiman's hugely popular book, you know, and all that does not necessarily mean Game of Thrones awesomeness, I guess, to put it in, you know, that's probably the best word I can use. So, yeah, curious. Any further things you want to talk about this episode, Mike, that we missed?
No, and we're really kind of getting into broader serious themes, so
that'll
be stepping on our toes for next week.
Yeah. All right, so yeah, that's pretty much this episode. Oddly, it was not the climax that you would have expected based off of what was discussed at the beginning of the show, meaning a war between gods. This episode was, like you said, felt more like a penultimate episode. And even then, it was more of a lackadaisical humorous episode with, you know, the multiple Jesuses and the rabbits and all this other stuff, rather than a big build-up suspenseful thing. So it's just a quirky show.
Well, I think they got the payoff at the end. I think the scene with Odin...
Yeah, but it was like
I think the staging was fantastic.
But Mike, it's like, but it's like you said though. It's like we all knew he was Odin anyway. So
yeah,
was it,
I know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was cool. You're right. It was like violent and all this other stuff where it's like whoa, and spring is gone and all this. But that was only 5 minutes of the show.
Right. That's fair.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, it's interesting. Again, I think it's just the quirkiness of the show. We'll talk about all that next week, the positives and negatives, and its success rate and what we probably will think. Again, it doesn't matter. It's just our opinion, and it also doesn't matter because it did get a renewal for season two, and also I think we both are enjoying the show either way, even if we think it's a little different than anything we've seen before. Anything else, Mike, that you wanted to bring up specifically on this episode?
No, I think I'm good.
All right, good. Yeah, if I stepped on your toes on mistake here, then I apologize.
No.
Okay, good. All right, so that's the last episode of the season, and we'll discuss the entire season next week. What do we call the wrap up season, right? Wrap up episode.
Yes.
So this was Come to Jesus. Next week will be a wrap up episode. So don't forget to check for our episode next week, because a lot of podcasts just end with the season finale, but we like usually doing a wrap up episode. So come back next week for sure. And we'll have a wrap-up where we'll talk about various themes and characters and so forth. Anything else you wanted to bring up about next week's episode, what we'll probably discuss?
No, we'll play it by ear and see what happens.
All right, sounds good. All right, so thanks for listening. And with that stated, Mike, why don't you do this out?
Once again, thank you for listening to Searching for American Gods, part of the Dark Discussions Podcast Network. Please, if you like us or don't like us or think we're mediocre, go on to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play and leave us a review. And please feel free to join us on our Facebook page at Dark Discussions Podcast. Or you can go on your email and send us an email to darkdiscussions@aol.com and let us know what you think there, whether it's about the show, whether it's about us or our thoughts, or whether you just want to add your own two cents. We're more than happy to share it with the rest of the listeners. So
yep, email.
We'll see you next week for the wrap-up.
DarkDiscussions@AOL.com. Send them in, and we'll read them on our final episode.
All right. So see you next week for our final our season one wrap-up. We hope you've enjoyed your time with us, and we'll see you then.